You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis.
Mr. President, First Is Us is a white nationalist organization comprised mostly of ex-cons, drug dealers, rogue veterans, violent thugs, sociopaths, and paintball enthusiasts. They seek the overthrow of the United States government.
No, they don't. They like me. It's the liberals in Michigan they want to overthrow.
Yes, Mr. President, but those people, as much as we disagree with them, were elected by the voters to serve.
Well, they shouldn't have been.
We have intelligence that indicates that two other citizen militias are ready to move on state legislatures in Wyoming and Idaho. If we allow the situation in Michigan to escalate, if we do not call in the National Guard, we are quite certain that this lawlessness will spread.
We call in the National Guard against anti-fascists, not against our own people. What the hell is wrong with you? I got a video shoot.
They're still setting up, Mr. President.
But we were late to this, so now we should be on time.
Yes, sir.
By the way, whose clock is it?
Sir?
Who owns time?
You do, Mr. President.
What I say goes, and that means schedule. And I should never be early for anything. I have to be anticipated. And if I'm not anticipated, I might as well be dead. Tell them they have 5 minutes to get ready to shoot, or they're all fired, and then I'll show up in 10.
Yes, sir, Mr. President.
What will take 10 minutes?
Well, perhaps you want to check back in with the Joint Chiefs.
Let's go set off a rocket.
That was a clip from Babbo Supreme, a little October surprise from Oscar winner Tim Robbins. This oral immersive experience is written, directed, and stars Robbins as an emotionally insecure, egomaniacal president run amok, alongside some of his favorite actor pals, including Jack Black, Isla Fisher, Patton Oswalt, and Haley Joel Osment, just to name a few. Following in the tradition of Robbins' 1992 film Bob Roberts, this satire is a hard-hitting, bitingly funny, no-holds-barred look at the hypocrisy, deception, and danger in the current American political landscape. Babbo Supreme debuts on Patreon Thursday, October 8th, and today I'm happy to welcome Tim back to the show to share how he originally developed his latest project as a movie with the director of The Big Short, Adam McKay, how he was inspired to adapt the script for an auditory medium when the pandemic shut down film production, and why he refers to the show as an oral cinema experience rather than a podcast. He reveals how he managed to record with 35 different actors in 35 different locations all at once during quarantine, and how it's given him a renewed appreciation for the radio dramas of Orson Welles' Mercury Radio Theater. We talk about taking down tyrants through satire, comedy as a welcome break from toxic doom-scrolling, and how Tim's career in Hollywood gives him an insight into the fragile, narcissistic id of Donald Trump. Then Tim speculates on how the movie business may transform in the wake of COVID-19 and what it'll take to reopen live theaters such as his own repertory group, The Actors Gang. Plus, how Joe Biden won Tim over, the enduring relevance of his film Bob Roberts, and why you probably won't see a sequel to that seminal political mockumentary anytime soon. Coming up with Tim Robbins in just a moment. Tim Robbins is an Academy Award-winning actor, screenwriter, director, producer, and musician known for such films as The Shawshank Redemption, Bull Durham, Bob Roberts, Mystic River, Dead Man Walking, and many others. Now he's making waves in a new medium for him with a brand new audio drama that's heavy on the political satire. Babo Supreme is about an infantile, narcissistic, lounge-singing, game show-hosting, narcoleptic racist, an unhinged id running for re-election as president and unwilling to cede power if he loses. Sound familiar? The first 5 episodes of Babo Supreme will debut October 8th on Patreon. Tim Robbins, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Well, Tim, I've heard you use this term that I've never heard before to describe Babo Supreme. You bill it as an oral cinema experience. What's the difference between that and a podcast or an audiobook or something?
Well, the script I wrote this summer, not this past summer, the summer before that, and I had been in talks with Adam McKay about going out to find financing to shoot it in the spring, and then COVID hit, and so I immediately started thinking about how to tell the same story in just an audio way. And what I realized was that, you know, unlike a lot of what you might call radio dramas that are in one room and pretty static, I wanted this to have a sense of motion. And because the screenplay, Babo, when they're following Babo Supreme, he is constantly on the move. He's moving from one location to another constantly. He's ADD, just like needs distraction constantly. So what I imagined when I was writing it was that that the White House had been transformed into a different set of different kinds of TV studios and radio shows. And he's got a Rose Garden morning show, and he's got a game show called Losers Suck, and he's got a recording studio where he goes in and records songs. And so I wanted to give the listener a sense of motion and a sense of place, of location, so that when they're listening, their imaginations can fill in the visuals. Hopefully, this will be true. I know that, you know, because of the restrictions that are placed on us and in this COVID time, that artists have to find new ways of expressing and finding ways to tell stories to communities, which is the thing I've missed the most about this time is that, you know, we have a theater in Los Angeles and we have this beautiful audience base that comes in, and we're able to share stories with them and create a temporary community with them, and that's lost right now. So how do we make that same community with people through their ears? How do we put out material that's relevant enough so that when the listener is listening, they can imagine the laughter of others, and also most importantly, know that they're not alone in their laughter, and know that they're not alone in their indignation about what's going on. Babo Supreme is not a Trump imitation. It's an imagination of what the unbridled psyche is of this current president. He is an entertainer. He's a singer. He's also a game show host. He's also the leader of the free world. And how do all those marry?
You mentioned that he's a singer. And of course, you know, it's not a big leap from Bob to Babo. And I've heard some people describing Babo Supreme as a sequel to Bob Roberts. Now, having listened to the first couple episodes, I feel like it's sort of maybe a spiritual cousin to Bob Roberts, but it's not necessarily a sequel per se, right?
It's definitely not a sequel. Yeah. Bob Roberts is, you know, the most elegant statesman compared to Babo Supreme.
That's true.
No, Babo had to be something else. As I was writing it, you know, I was imagining this character called Ubu the King, which is this play that was written in 1900 or something. The first performance of it, the audience ripped up the seats of the theater and rioted. They were so appalled by this character that Alfred Jarry had created. And in a way, it was kind of this turning point for theater and for storytelling, because it imagined the worst possible id of a person that ascends to the throne of Poland. And in doing so, he kind of laid the groundwork for Dadaism and Expressionism and Surrealism. He was the first, and it was also the first play the Actors Gang did. It was how we came to prominence in Los Angeles. We did a midnight show of Ubu Wa that ran for 6 months in 1982. And so as I was writing, I was imagining Ubu's voice. And for a while in the screenplay, he was called Ubu, but I changed it to Babo because that sounds more fun than Ubu.
Just out of curiosity, have you ever thought about doing a straight-up sequel to Bob Roberts over the years? I'm sure people ask.
People have asked, and yeah. I've thought about it. But, you know, I'm not a big fan of sequels. Mm-hmm. But I think Spiritual Cousin is a good description of Babo Supreme.
Yeah. Now, I'm sure that Bob Roberts has come up pretty often over the years just because, A, it's such a great movie and really one of the early narrative films that uses that pseudo-documentary style. But the fact is, most political films really don't age very well. And yet, here you have this film that is insanely relevant right now. Did you ever imagine coming up on almost 30 years after it came out that Bob Roberts would still be so culturally and politically relevant and indeed sort of prophetic of these times?
Well, thank you, and I'm sorry. I had no idea at the time. I meant it as a warning. I meant it as a means to tell the story of a rise of a certain kind of celebrity politics. Mm-hmm. No, I did not imagine in 1992 when that film came out that. We would have someone like Bob Roberts in the White House. But I did realize that it was possible. Yeah. And that was the reason why I did it.
You know, satire is just the ideal way to take down this president. Because when you just launch into a direct attack of Trump on his record, behavior, criminality, whatever, you know, he can pretty effectively marshal his followers and rebut that on Twitter. But when he's confronted with satire, I honestly think that he doesn't know how to respond to that. Aside from the fact that it's probably just completely over his head, I think that satire is just extremely difficult to counter. I mean, inevitably, you look like a fool if you take it seriously and bother to respond, right?
Well, this is why it exists. This is why art exists, is to reflect the truth that can't be told. Mm-hmm. It's why great theater exists, great movies, great works of visual art. They try to illuminate a truth that is not being told. And the good thing about satire is that it takes us to this common ground where we can identify what is relevant in it, mm-hmm. and laugh about it. This is what we need right now. Everyone is lost in this cycle of news. Every day it's depressing. Every day it's offensive. Every day there's a new outrage. And in a way, I'd love to encourage people just to take an hour and a half outside of these nightly depressing news shows and laugh a little bit. And because laughter, with any emotion, is empowerment. When you can share an emotion with someone, if you can listen to this with somebody and laugh together, or if you're alone, just to laugh, is so essential. It will give you power. It is why it is feared. It is why when an authoritarian regime takes over, the first people they go after are the artists and the intellectuals, because they know that those people have the power to bring them down. And it's through laughter. I think Nick Kristof wrote something in the New York Times last Sunday about this, that humor is a weapon. Humor can be a powerful weapon because it can possess in it truth. And I'm talking about true satire. I'm talking about satire that dares to be dangerous, mm-hmm. and rude and honest. It's not about an imitation of Trump. It's not about a parody of Trump. It is Babo Supreme. And Babo Supreme is the manifestation of all of those dreams that you're having, all of those nightmares you're having. And in fact, it's set in a dreamscape. We don't. Right. We're not sure whether we're dreaming or we're actually hearing the reality. That's a significant and important distinction between parody and satire.
Yeah, and I have to say that I love that title, Babo Supreme, because it just speaks to this president's reliance on this over-the-top hyperbole and the sense of self that is so wildly divorced from reality. I have to say, Tim, you really have a disturbing level of insight into the Trump id. Where does that come from? Where do you get
that? I think it comes from me, yeah. Honestly. You know, I think here's the thing. I think we all have it in us. Mm-hmm. We all have that id, where some of us are better at controlling it. Mm-hmm. Some of us know that empathy and compassion are the best battle, the best fighters against the id. Some of us allow empathy and compassion to dominate our lives. But we all have this in us. It's identifiable in all of us. That primal id, that unchecked id, is within all of us. Mm-hmm. And so it's I'm not saying this is, you know, about left versus right or against this or against that. It's kind of an acknowledgement of the time we're in and the environment we're in. And I can easily see identifying my own tendencies towards these outrageous thoughts and really? Behavior. You know, of course, we're all, think about it. We're all in a battle right now. We're all in this like kind of like fight for the future of America. Mm-hmm. And is it the time to be polite and reserved and diplomatic, or is it time to take off the gloves and mm-hmm. fight? Mm-hmm. And so, yes, I mean, after Bob Roberts came out, when a close friend of mine said, you know, this is you. And I'm like, oh, what do you mean? He says, your dad was a folk singer. This. And he was right. You know, we all have this in us, you know. It's why it's scary. It's why it's frightening to us, is because it's something that is easily achievable if you check your empathy and your compassion at the door.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to be careful when we're proceeding with this, right? If we are able to change things, we have to be able to have love in our hearts.
Yeah.
We have to be able to be driven by love. That's where we can differentiate our id from yeah. theirs.
I wonder, as an actor, there must have been times in your career where you just thought that your shit didn't stink and you were on this kind of ego high. So in that sense, can you kind of relate to that euphoria?
This is the thing that was the biggest challenge about mm-hmm. becoming famous and about having this new platform, was to check myself, you know, constantly. You get to a certain level of celebrity or power, and you're surrounded by people that are yes men and people that are there to buoy you up and to tell you you're great. And so you wind up doing shitty movies, and no one tells you they're shitty. And then you keep doing shitty movies, and before you know it, you're lost, right? And it's the same thing in the trajectory of politicians. You get to a certain amount of power, mm-hmm. and people tell you you're great, and there's no one around there to be honest with you. And with this particular administration, those that dared to be honest were fired, just summarily yeah. executed out of the freaking scene. And that's no accident. That's because there's a fragility here. There's a fragility in this man. There is a wounded child who doesn't want to be wrong. He has never been wrong. He's never had to take responsibility for anything. And so you can approach writing that as, well, it's an adult man that's making conscious decisions, or you can realize it is this uncontrolled child and a child that is lacking certain things. And yes, that is in show business as well, that unchecked ego. It is there. That is the seduction. That is the danger. That is the pit that people fall in, and on both sides.
Yeah.
I've met people that I knew when they were younger, who were incredibly progressive, leftist, and have now, you know, modified themselves. Now, are they modifying themselves out of some kind of new discovery or self-discovery, or are they modifying themselves for convenience, to continue their run, to stay in that echelon?
Mm-hmm.
That's a question everyone has to answer for themselves. It's a difficult question, and it involves self-evaluation. And it also involves humility. You have to be able to humble enough to be able to say, you know what, I might not know. I might actually be wrong. This is something I think was severely lacking after the last election.
Yeah. But I do think that we have to give some credit to those Republicans who it can't have been an easy decision, who broke with Trump. And there are quite a number of them. They're just not in power anymore. But that takes a lot of character, I have to say.
And good for them for doing that. But what Trump has revealed is that he's just not as good as at hiding the agenda. Mm. But in fact, a lot of his agenda, people are fine with.
Yeah.
It's just his demeanor that is offensive.
Yeah.
And so I'm glad that there are people that are breaking with him. But for me, that doesn't make them heroes. I know what their policies are. I know that they've voted in the past for restrictions to health care. Some of them want to get rid of Obamacare. Most of them oppose health care for all. Some of them are involved in decisions that led to children being locked up in cages at the border. So, it does to break with Trump is one thing. To break with the policy is another. Mm-hmm. And that's where I hope we're headed as a country, that we can get into a more humane and compassionate existence where we can actually listen to the concerns of the poor and the working class. Those people don't seem to be served by either constituency. And those people are the people I come from. That is how I grew up. And I'm never going to forget that. That is who I am. I have been so lucky, I've been so blessed to have had the success that I've had. But I've always stood and marched on the side of the people that don't have a voice and that are underrepresented in the country.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. One of the key plot points of this show seems ripped from the first debate when Bobo Supreme refuses to denounce a white supremacist militia that's intent on overthrowing legitimately elected officials. And he even throws out these thinly veiled racist dog whistles to egg them on. I have to ask, what did you make of Trump's refusal to denounce the Proud Boys in the debate and his use of that phrase, stand back, stand by? Was that just him being inarticulate as usual and fumbling for words, or did you take that as a coded message to that group?
No, that was definitely a coded message, mm-hmm. and that was intentional. That wasn't a mistake.
Yeah.
But this was, you could read this all the way back to Charlottesville.
Right.
I wrote that thing you're just talking about the militia taking over the state legislature. I wrote that a summer ago, past summer, the year before. That was in the script.
Wow.
Because that was the logical extension of the dog whistles he was putting out at the time. Mm-hmm. It is, you don't do that unless it's some kind of weird strategy. And for me, it was, oh, I see. So he's going to solidify this small base of supporters that have never been talked to on that scale by a president, that have always been ignored. They've been courted. Their votes have been wanted, and there's been certain dog whistles thrown out. Reagan did it. Nixon did it. But did they ever really have the president acknowledging their existence? No, because that was too politically risky. Now, here he's doing it at Charlottesville when he said, there are good people on both sides. And that's a clear message to those folks. Not only that, but in policy, he got rid of one of the groups that was monitoring those groups.
Right, that's true.
The government monitoring of those groups stopped under his administration.
Yeah.
That's not an accident. That's because he understands something far darker than many of us want to imagine, mm-hmm. which is, I think, if he loses the election, we will see it play out, and that's tragic. And that is a death of something in this country, if it happens. Will he give up his office, or will he... He's already telling his supporters to be poll monitors. That's illegal. He can't do that. And if they show up with guns to the polls, mm-hmm. this is where it's headed. And it's in Babbo Supreme. In the later episodes, that exact thing happens. He calls out his supporters to bring guns to the polls.
Well, yeah, your fictional president is freaking out when he looks at the polls because he's certain that he's going to go to jail if he doesn't get reelected. It's not hard to imagine that's what's going through his mind right now. But there's another point in that episode. One of Babbo's aides says that the country would never convict a former president because it would basically destroy the presidency in the country. And that's kind of the same argument that we heard when Ford pardoned Nixon, that it would erode our faith in democracy and the office of the president would never be able to recover from it. And yet it seems so fundamentally antithetical to our founding principles. Do you buy into this idea that holding the most powerful man in the country accountable for his actions, just as anyone else would be, is somehow too much for the American people to handle?
Well, I'll ask a question of you. Are you aware that of the amounts of crimes that are committed by people that are incredibly wealthy and never, never, never go to jail? We have two systems.
I'm not aware.
We have two systems of justice in this country. Yeah. There's two systems of justice in this country. Yeah. I work in the California prison system with the Actors Gang Prison Project. Yeah. And believe me, there are no wealthy people in the groups that we work with. Mm-hmm. There are crimes that are not. There are people I have worked with that were, up until a couple of years ago, because of some legislation that was passed, were spending the rest of their lives in jail for a nonviolent crime because of the three strikes law.
Yeah.
Now you have people that pollute rivers. People die of cancer. And there is no ramifications for it. The corporate crimes are, maybe a fine once in a while. But the fine, if you look at their profit margins, is minuscule. Look what happened when in 2008. It was a massive robbery of 401ks. People were busted from that. Busted, they lost their money. There was no one busted for the crime. In fact, it just kept going and going and going. So, the person, the average Joe, the working class person, the poor person, even the Trump supporters, know this to be true. They know that there is, that their 401ks went away. Their bank accounts went away. That's robbery. Why wasn't the crime prosecuted? That's something that we have to answer, right? Until we answer that, until there is justice for that, then there is just hypocrisy. And so people lose their respect for the institutions because the institutions will not police themselves. That's where we are today. That's why there was such a fertile ground for Trump, because there have been years of this. Between NAFTA, sending good-paying American jobs overseas, to the crisis in 2008, the average person knows, wait a second, what's going on here? And why am I paying these taxes when these guys don't pay any taxes at all? And why has my minimum wage job not had a rise in 20 years? Why is the minimum wage stuck where it's stuck? It's not a living wage. And why do I have to work 4 jobs to survive, to put my kid through school? How is that possible in the richest country in the world? And these are, I'm sorry, But that is, until we answer those questions, until we do some self-evaluation about that, until we that are opposing this administration can look at ourselves and say, how can we be better? How can we better serve the majority of the people in the United States? Then we're going to keep spiraling into this pit of confrontation and altercation.
Yeah, and I want to ask you, because I know that you supported Bernie last election. I'm not sure where you were this election, but previously you supported the Green Party. And in Babo Supreme, you have this Democratic nominee known as Milquetoast. And Babo actually gets his ass handed to him, not by the anointed opponent, at least as far as I've heard so far, but by a third party candidate. Can we read into this character, Milquetoast, and what happens in here? Something maybe that's indicative of your enthusiasm or lack of enthusiasm for Biden.
I'm voting for Biden.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm going to make that very clear.
It's official.
It's official. As one of my characters in Babo Supreme says, I would vote for a bag of discarded toxic fat from a liposuction operation before I'd vote for this.
That is voting for Trump. What are you talking about?
No, beyond that, you know, that's a joke. You know,
okay.
I think the man has a decency that is needed right now in this country.
Yeah,
I believe he actually is a man that would listen to someone advocating for a more progressive stance. I'm not creating an illusion in my head that he is a progressive reformer, but I do know that there is a more of an open ear in a Biden administration than there would be in a future Trump administration.
Okay.
I also believe that a future Trump administration will be the end of America as we know it.
Yeah.
It's already unbridled. It's already unhinged. And where it goes from here is not going to be something that we want to live in.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, I'm voting for Biden. I hope he wins. I hope we can turn the Senate so that we can get more progressive legislation passed and more judges that aren't ideologues and that are going to rule for, corrupt business interests. We're in bad shape, though. There's a lot of work to do. And
definitely.
I think it's like staving off a disaster right now. I think we're in a disaster right now, and we need someone that can at least acknowledge that it's a disaster and not the best, most incredible thing that's ever happened ever to the presidency since Lincoln. You know, we need a sane, rational man or woman in the White House.
That would be nice. Well, in the time we have left, I want to talk about the production of Babo Supreme. From a technical standpoint, this is quite an accomplishment to gather all these actors and make this during quarantine. First off, just tell us some of the actors that joined you in this project.
Well, we have Jack Black, Isla Fisher, Ray Wise, Alfre Woodard,
wow.
Ted Levine, Patton Oswalt, Haley Joel Osment, Kerry Kinney, Tom Lennon, and Ricky Lindholm, and this fabulous stand-up and great singer named Rita Brent.
Wow. And I was interested to learn that you and the cast recorded with one another in real time. In other words, they weren't just recording their lines individually and you sync it up in post. It seems to me that that's so important for actors to be able to play off of each other, especially when you're doing comedy. How did you pull that off?
Technology. it was challenging, very challenging. We had 35 different locations where we were recording from.
Wow.
And at one point we had, about 20, 30 of them on at once, all feeding into an engineer at a different location. It was great. It was so great to do, you know, all of us having been locked down and not being able to do anything creative for a while. And now here we are all together talking about community, to create something together. I was so humbled and blessed that everyone said yes when I sent them the script. It was the timing issue. That's the most difficult thing, because in comedy, it's all about timing.
Yeah.
And so what you would think would be difficult is even more difficult, because you can't really overlap. You can't really have that kind of pace.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
I was encouraging people to, I knew it had to move like a speed, you know, it had to move with all speed. It had to move like a bullet train. There could be no pausing and no, you know, I said, listen, we'll create those pauses if we need them later. But what we wound up doing is, and what I found it was so awesome about the process was that as I was editing it, it was like I was editing a film. It needed as much attention to detail and as much attention to every specific moment as editing a film does. And so it took us about 6 weeks to edit it. I was expecting it to take 3, but what I realized was, oh, if we're really going to try to create this experience of this, what I would like to call a film for the ears, you have to be as diligent with the timing and with the urgency as you would be in a film.
For a while back, you wrote and directed just an excellent movie. It's one of my favorites of yours, Cradle Will Rock, about Orson Welles directing that famous play of the same name in the 30s. And of course, Welles and the Mercury Theater really pioneered radio drama. People know War of the Worlds, but he also did these very smart productions of classics like A Tale of Two Cities, Julius Caesar, Jane Eyre. Have you thought much about how you're continuing that tradition and maybe even playing a role in reviving the genre?
I hope so, because here's the thing that's relevant about what Welles was doing with the Mercury Theater. He was doing pieces that resonated with the audience. The War of the Worlds and Julius Caesar were done with the same time that fascism was on the rise in Germany.
Wow.
They were telling stories that were so resonant. The idea of an alien invasion, the idea of Julius Caesar, the power struggle in that was, every listener at the time was thinking, oh my goodness, that's what's happening right now.
Yeah.
And that's the key to creating effective entertainment in this time. I don't believe that benign distraction works right now. We are in a very extraordinary and strange time. And so in order to create stories that resonate with an audience, we have to acknowledge that first. We have to know that our the restrictions that are placed on us are actually the keys that will get us to the kind of storytelling we need to get to. And it is all about the material. What kind of stories are we telling? How will they resonate with an audience right now? Mm. It's a wholly different environment than it was even a year ago.
Yeah.
The kinds of stories you could tell a year ago are entirely different from the kinds of stories you can tell now. Now, I know that people will try to, you know, just say, hey, you know, we're going to go back to those, you know, rom-coms and action movies and everything will be fine. I'm not so sure. I kind of view this as a significant cultural shift that could occur right now.
Interesting.
So it's very similar to what happened with Easy Rider with films in the early 70s, in the 60s and the early 70s. Easy Rider was made at the time the studios weren't doing very well. They were, you know, doing Thoroughly Modern Millie and no one came to it, right? And
yeah.
And they wondered, where's our audience? It's television has gotten our audience. And then Dennis Hopper gets the keys to the car, makes this film, it's a huge hit. Hollywood is like, oh my goodness, people actually want to go to the movies. And what do? They give the keys to the car to Coppola, Scorsese, Kula, Hal Ashby, and all these incredible films are made. Robert Altman, all of these incredible films are made in the 70s. People didn't want to go see Thoroughly Modern Millie anymore.
Right.
There were people on the streets fighting for their lives.
trying to end a war. That's an entirely different environment than the ones that had preceded it, that Hollywood had embraced. Yeah.
It also makes me think of the post-war period, from the mid to late 40s, there was that window when, after 4 or 5 years of cinema as distraction, you had noir emerge and serious cinema and message pictures. So I could see that happening as well.
Hopefully, we haven't gone too far into a, corporate thing, that Hollywood can adjust and start making more relevant stories. One reason I just absolutely loved the fact that Parasite won Best Picture, and Best Picture for foreign and domestic, because it was the Academy saying to the business, let's do films like this.
Mm-hmm.
This is what it was about. It's about a poor person. They were all poor.
Yeah.
That resonated with people.
And real quickly before we go, I do want to ask you about the future of live theater, because you are, as you mentioned, the founding artistic director of the Actors Gang here in L.A. Have you given very much thought to how theater is going to emerge from all of this and what you'll have to do to get audiences to feel comfortable going to a live performance again?
I've been thinking a lot about it. I know that it has to be dangerous. I know that it has to cross over a line that we haven't crossed over yet. As far as physical contact, I know that it has to be brave and it has to tell a story that will resonate.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working on it now. It's probably going to go into workshop as soon as I can get actors into a room.
Mm-hmm.
To develop the piece. I know that what we had planned on doing in the past, the things we had been talking about doing this coming year, I know that we will not be doing those. And it's really a matter of, again, acknowledging with humility what is really happening and not trying to fight against it, not trying to do a musical in our living rooms, not trying to create theater through Zoom. Because it inherently is a visual medium, Zoom. So it becomes a film. And so if we're going to do that, we can look at it by doing it as a film.
Mm.
It's not as simple as turning the cameras on, though. Film is intricate. Film requires writing, rewriting, editing, filming, editing, editing, editing. And it's not fast.
Yeah.
And so you either do one or the other. I don't believe in the marriage of it. I think Zoom can be wonderful for forums, for discussions, for checking in with each other. And it's been, quite frankly, the way most people have been doing business.
Mm-hmm.
But right. As far as art goes, art has to adjust. Art has to adapt. Yeah. And it has to be relevant. I think a lot about the mystery plays that were done right after the play. These kind of quasi-religious, but sort of obscene plays that they would do, kind of like Commedia dell'arte, traveling from town to town.
Yeah.
I think a lot about that. I think about, what was it like to go into a town that had been devastated by the plague and perform something? What was that? What was the material?
Yeah. God, it's crazy to think. But, I guess we do adapt. So that's a good sign for the future, hopefully.
Oh, we'll figure it out. We'll figure it out.
You bet. Once more, the immersive oral entertainment experience, Babbo Supreme, debuts October 8th on Patreon.
You can also find the link on babbosupreme.com.
Oh, okay.
And, yeah, and I'll have links on my social media, Tim Robbins 1 and on Twitter, and Tim Robbins here on Instagram. And I have a Facebook thing that I rarely use, but apparently someone's going to be posting on it.
Well, terrific. I really enjoyed it, and God knows we need a laugh right now. So, Tim Robbins, thanks so much for talking with me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Ben.
Thanks again to Tim Robbins for returning to the show. Once more, episode 1 of Babbo Supreme debuts today, October 8th, on Patreon. Visit babbosupreme.com or patreon.com/TimRobbinsPresents to listen. and follow Tim on Twitter at @TimRobbins1. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.